Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Other Minds and Hands. This is episode number 67, and today Maggie and I return from Arrakis, and we are headed to Neverland today. We're returning to our little sub-series on children's literature adaptations. We've talked about Alice in Wonderland, we've talked about Winnie the Pooh, and today we're going to talk about Peter Pan, as we suggested that we're going to get to. And Peter Pan is a really complicated case for adaptation, which I think we just kind of need to acknowledge at the beginning. Yeah. This is, you know, normally every time, all the other times, we've had a book and then we've been looking at a series of film adaptations of that book. But this is different.
Yeah, and like 99% of the time when somebody mentions the word adaptation, they're talking book to film. Like, that is just what we're used to. That's where the brain goes. So even when we first started talking about Peter Pan, I was just immediately like, yeah, book to film. And then you're like, hang on. Because it's not. It didn't exactly go that way. Yeah, and it wasn't until we started talking about tonight where we were like, wait a minute, have we done a play? And I don't think we have. You know, some of the things we've talked about have turned into plays or musicals or whatever. But starting with a play, and I should have looked up the timeline, but it was something like 1907 was the first play, and the novelization was like 1924. But that's also the year that the first silent film came out of Peter Pan that was basically just a filming of the stage play. So it's a really interesting one, I think, for us to talk about in terms of adaptation. But we wanted to acknowledge we're looking at a different platform here.
It's a complicated step. Yeah, and also, I mean, I will say that in this sense, in some ways, I feel like in the strict sense, we're talking about adaptations, and I certainly didn't see the original stage play, I didn't see it in the 1910s, believe it or not. And, but not only that, I mean, I haven't even seen like a stage play, which is trying to do like something like the original or
I've seen the musical quite a few times, like the stage musical, but the stage play, I can't even think of it being put on. You know, you think that would be like excellent fodder for elementary and high school productions, but I think they just go for the musical if there is one.
Yeah. So
yeah,
exactly.
Not as prolific.
So in other words, we have to sort of acknowledge that all the things we're discussing, including the books, like the book is itself an adaptation. The book was the play adapted to book form. In fact, you know what it reminds me of, Maggie? It reminds me of The Princess Bride. Which there you did get the book before you got the screenplay, but the book is like sort of originally a screenplay. Anyway, it's complicated, right? But this is less
medium.
Yes, this is less kind of thorny in some ways than the Princess Bride question. But it's still a peculiar situation for us in that we're basically not talking about the original at all. Like, all the things that we're talking about are adaptations, including the book. Yeah. And that's an interesting and peculiar situation. And so one of the things that it means is when we talk about the relationship, I don't even know that we can talk about the relationship between the book and the film in exactly the same way, because it's not clear that that's really the primary thing.
Right. Like, our primary text was 1904. And I think the one thing that does kind of tie these together is J.M. Barrie did both. So he did the stage play and he did the novelization.
Sure.
So it's still his story, and it's, I don't know, it feels different than like Goldman doing Princess Bride. You know, he was so aware of how this is going to be received in Hollywood and the machina of all of that, like doing this in the 1920s, totally different. I don't know. Somehow I wasn't there. This is just me conjecturing, but I feel like it's more pure of his interpretation of the story. So I feel like both could be viewed as original source material. Even if we didn't see the 1904 stage play, I feel like the 1924 novelization can still be seen as like the first, right? Like, I don't know.
In a sense, and certainly since, again, I'm assuming that, you know, most of the people working on the later film adaptations also hadn't seen the 1904 play, you know. But still, the thing I think that I'm pointing to, though, when I talk about it, is that it's like, what is the root of the tree, you know?
Yeah.
With most of the other things we've discussed, you've got the book, which is the root. And it can have different offshoots, like Winnie the Pooh, for instance, right? Winnie the Pooh was also a stage play, a very popular stage play, contemporaneous with that, but the book came first, right? Yeah. So the stage play was one adaptation of the book, right? And then the later films were another adaptation, sort of a separate branch, right? In this case, the book is not like the trunk of the tree, right? The play is the trunk of the tree. His book is one branch, you know, and it is like an authorial branch of that. I mean, he did do it. It's not that I don't consider that his story, but the thing that is to me interesting is that it's not obvious to me that the later film adaptations are growing out of that branch. Like that they're branch, like yeah. sort of a separate branch conceivably. Yeah. And this is the thing that we've kind of acknowledged at various other points that it's something. And even with Tolkien stuff, this comes up all the time. It came up with Peter Jackson stuff that people, book fans who are watching a film adaptation are very, very often think of like the book as the only source text, like that is the original that the filmmaker is positioning themselves like with and against, right? But in the minds of the filmmakers, especially when you're talking about a film, a book that has been adapted in film many times before, it's not necessarily primarily the book that the director is thinking of. An obvious and sort of, I think, extreme example of this is Dracula, right? Mm. Dracula has had classic film adaptations from very, very early on. And as a big fan of the book Dracula, I tend to be thinking of the book all the time. I'll see a new Dracula adaptation, right? And I'm thinking about the book. I'm thinking about the relationship between the film and the book all the time, as if the filmmaker was just sitting down and being like, I have this book in a vacuum that I'm going to make a movie out of, right? But right. In the case of Dracula, it is so obvious. There's like generations worth of films that have influenced those people, right? And it is very likely that they are going to be thinking about, you know, Bela Lugosi or even Francis Ford Coppola at least as much as they're thinking about Bram Stoker. I mean, like, that's just the reality of the situation.
And a film like that is so iconic that it influences so many other things within the same genre that, like,
yes.
you can see nods to Dracula in completely unrelated other films. You know, yes. they're not adaptations of Dracula, but you still recognize Dracula. I think similarly, if there's an iconic adaptation done by a big studio like Disney, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, Peter Pan, when you say it, 99% of the time is 100% going to be just
that cartoon,
you know. Yeah. So then following that and being aware of whatever came before, like you'd have to at least be aware of it. It you can't just be in a vacuum. I don't think. Maybe you can try, but your whole audience is going to be predetermined and ready for something that ilks more towards Disney.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which is, I don't know if the trees and branches metaphor is a perfectly useful one at the end of the day, but it's like if the reason I'm thinking about it is that some later films are like branchings of the branch. It goes back to the book originally, but it's not like coming straight.
I don't know if you've watched Loki yet, but I'm picturing the Loom. I think it's the Loom.
Yes.
You know, so many of these things, or a tree where the branches grow back together at certain points. Yes. Like, there's some other imagery here that's going to work. But for something as pervasive as this, that's been around for 120 years, you're going to have a ton of adaptations that feed into each other from different things. And, you know, again, reading through the list of adaptations that have come from the stage play, there's graphic novels, there's musicals, there's stage plays, there's films, there's novelizations, there's autobiographical things about J.M. Barrie. And I mean, Finding Neverland was one of my like top ones that we should talk about tonight, purely because to me it's right up there with a Peter Pan adaptation, because it takes that story so strongly in there. But it's not. It's a, you know, nonfiction, but Yeah. Anyway, so this is a really interesting one, I think, for us to take a look at. It's slightly different than just looking at an opening and seeing how the opening tells the story. But we're going to start with that anyway.
We're going to start with that anyway. Exactly. Right.
We're still going to go through there.
Yeah. Yeah. But it really, one of the things that it really helps to, I don't know, just to really emphasize for me is, as I've, you know, been learning and as I've been thinking more and more as we've talked through these things, it really kind of emphasizes the, the fruitlessness of merely having the question you ask be, how much have they changed from the book, you know? And it really, this just really kind of shines a spotlight on that issue. You know, we have here two almost, I won't say they're independent, because it's not like the Disney people, when they made the cartoon, had never read the book, you know, even if they were primarily thinking about the play or the musical. But anyway, it's, mm-hmm. it's clearly, there are ways in which I'm more aware of the fact that what we're looking at are like two separate texts that are connected to each other, right? That are related to each other, but it's not, one is not obviously an exclusively derivative of the other, in the way in which we often think about adaptations. You want to read the beginning of the book? Shall we read the beginning? Okay. Chapter one. This is a very, just as a footnote, I find this very strange. But anyway, okay. All children except one. So the chapter one is called Peter Breaks Through.
Wait, all which children. Part do you find really, which part do you find really strange?
All of it. I find everything about it very strange. No, not that I'm reading the book. I find everything that I'm reading.
Conversation.
Right. No, I'm finding everything in the book very strange. Like that's yeah. Everything in the book very strange. All children except one grow up. They soon know that they will grow up. And the way Wendy knew was this. One day when she was 2 years old, she was playing in a garden and she plucked another flower and ran with it to her mother. I suppose she must have looked rather delightful, for Mrs. Darling put her hand to her heart and cried, "Oh, why can't you remain like this forever?" This was all that passed between them on the subject, but henceforth Wendy knew that she must grow up. You always know after you are two. Two is the beginning of the end.
Oh, that's grim.
Isn't that grim? Okay. Sorry, I know this is hitting you right where you live here, Maggie.
I'm like, guys, my kid's gonna be three in June.
It's past the beginning of the end already.
Sorry, Hazel, it's all over.
It's all over. Okay. Of course, they lived at 14, their house number on their street, and until Wendy came, her mother was the chief one. She was a lovely lady, with a romantic mind and such a sweet mocking mouth. Her romantic mind was like the tiny boxes, one within the other, that come from the puzzling East. However many you discover, there is always more. And her sweet, mocking mouth had one kiss on it that Wendy could never get, though there it was, perfectly conspicuous in the right-hand corner. So, first general observation. The first paragraph is about Wendy, right?
Yeah.
And the first paragraph takes Wendy absolutely for granted as kind of our frame, right? A second sentence. They soon know they will all grow up. And the way Wendy knew was this, right? We're not introduced to Wendy. We're just told something about Wendy and we're supposed to keep up, right? Being supposed to keep up is something I feel like is being asked of me at many points, in the opening chapter of this book. Okay. But we get this immediate transition from Wendy to her mother, Mrs. Darling, in the second paragraph, right? Until Wendy came, her mother was the chief one. Hmm. One what? We're not told exactly. Female? Like, is it a girl, like, woman thing or person? But I don't know, chief one what?
And until Wendy came, like, has she replaced her mother as the chief one?
And apparently, it seems that that's the mm-hmm. implication. But the whole second paragraph is about the mother, which is, It's odd. But anyway, it gets odder. Okay. Let's talk about that kiss that is on the sweet mocking mouth of Wendy's mother, and which Wendy could never get. Wendy could never get this kiss. But there it was, perfectly conspicuous. The way Mr. Darling won her was this. The many gentlemen who had been boys when she was a girl discovered simultaneously that they loved her, and they all ran to her house to propose to her, except Mr. Darling, who took a cab and nipped in first, and so he got her. He got all of her, except the innermost box and the kiss. He never knew about the box, and in time he gave up trying for the kiss. Wendy thought Napoleon could have got it, but I can picture him trying and then going off in a passion, slamming the door. It's
been
weird.
It's a long time since I've read this.
How weird is this? Okay. Mr. Very. Darling used to boast to Wendy that her mother not only loved him, but respected him. He was one of those deep ones who know about stocks and shares. Of course, no one really knows, but he quite seemed to know. And he often said stocks were up and shares were down in a way that would have made any woman respect him. Mrs. Darling was married in white, and at first she kept the books perfectly, almost gleefully, as if it were a game. Not so much as a Brussels sprout was missing. But by and by, whole cauliflowers dropped out, and instead of them, there were pictures of babies without faces. She drew them when she should have been totting up. They were Mrs. Darling's guesses. Wendy came first, then John, then Michael. Now, after this comes a long discussion of their debate as to whether or not they're going to keep Wendy when she shows up and whether or not they can afford it in their household finances. Though we're told that, though narrowly, they decided that they would keep Wendy and adjust their finances accordingly. And John and Michael, who are even nearer shaves, are in fact also retained. So there we are.
Surreal.
It's quite surreal. Now the vast majority of the entire first chapter is about Mrs. Darling. Mm.
Sorry, I'm here. My camera keeps freezing again.
Yeah, that's okay. It's okay. So we're introduced to, to Nana the nursemaid as well, the Newfoundland dog. We're introduced to Peter Pan, though. Let me just read. I'm not even going to comment on it. Let me just read the paragraph in which we're introduced to Peter Pan. At the end of one paragraph, the last sentence is, "There never was a simpler, happier family until the coming of Peter Pan." Mrs. Darling first heard of Peter when she was tidying up her children's minds. It is the nightly custom of every good mother, after her children are asleep, to rummage in their minds and put things straight for next morning, repacking into their proper places the many articles that have wandered during the day. If you could keep awake, but of course you can't, you would see your own mother doing this, and you would find it very interesting to watch her. It is quite like tidying up drawers. You would see her on her knees, I expect, lingering humorously over some of your contents, wondering where on earth you had picked this up, making discoveries, sweet and not so sweet, pressing this to her cheek as if it were as nice as a kitten, and hurriedly stowing that out of sight. When you wake in the morning, the naughtiness and evil passions with which you went to bed have been folded up small and placed at the bottom of your mind, and on the top, beautifully aired, are spread out your prettier thoughts, ready for you to put on. I don't know whether you've ever seen a map of a person. Not my. This is, what does this have to do with Peter Pan, right?
Yeah.
Peter Pan, of course, is introduced later on as one of the things that she discovers in their minds, though we're introduced to Neverland first. That's the next paragraph. I don't know whether you have ever seen a map of a person's mind. Doctors sometimes draw maps of other parts of you, and your own map can become intensely interesting. But catch them trying to draw a map of a child's mind, which is not only confused, but keeps going round all the time. There are zigzag lines on it, just like your temperature on a card. And these are probably roads in the island, for the Neverland is always more or less an island, with astonishing splashes of color here and there, and coral reefs, and rakish-looking craft in the offing, and savages and lonely lairs, and gnomes who are mostly tailors, and caves through which a river runs, and princes with six elder brothers, and a hut fast going to decay, and one very small old lady with a hooked nose. It would be an easy map if that were all, but there is also first day at school, religion, fathers, the round pond, needlework, murders, hangings, verbs that take the dative, chocolate pudding day, getting into braces, say 99, threepence for pulling out your tooth yourself, and so on, and either these are part of the island or they are on another map, showing through, and it is all rather confusing, especially as nothing will stand. Of course, the Neverlands vary a good deal. Okay. So, you...
What?
You, no, right?
It's, I mean, especially because, like, I consider myself fairly well-versed in Peter Pan, but clearly I'm not, because this is not what I was familiar with.
Yes.
With the opiates? I mean, this is
it's
mad.
Very strange. It's very strange. Yeah. And yes, yes, these are the kinds of braces that stop your trousers falling yeah. down rather than holding your teeth in. Yes.
The British name for suspenders.
Exactly.
Which don't mix that up, because suspenders in the UK are garter belts. Did that once.
Gotcha. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. One of several embarrassing mistakes to make as an American in the UK. Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. So yes. Braces hold your trousers up.
Yeah. Adrian says this sounds like a fever dream. Yeah. It's. Yeah. It's odd. It's very... Now, of course, like...
I mean, I like the sentiment of the mother unpacking a children's brain. You know, that's quite a sweet way to show a mother's care. Like, I can get that as, like, a way to illustrate Mrs. Darling and what kind of mother she is. But then it descends into madness. Like, it feels very, like, Alice in Wonderland falling down the rabbit hole, doesn't it?
A little bit. Yeah. And so notice how he introduces Neverland in the same way he introduces Wendy. Right. That is, he doesn't. In the middle of the paragraph, he's talking about the map of a child's mind, says there are zigzag lines on it, just like your temperature on a card. And these are probably roads in the island, for the Neverland is always more or less an island. He just drops it out there in the middle of the Neverland. And in context, it sounds fairly clear, I think, that the Neverland is like the name, the general name for like the map, the child's mind that is being mapped. Like the, I think, though it's not really clear to me exactly what it is. When he goes on to say that Neverlands vary a good deal.
Yeah, probably from person to person.
Yeah, he's talking about like, again, child's, child's imagination. Phil says, are we seeing why Phil. Johnny Depp was cast as J.M. Barrie?
Well, and then that took me out for a minute, because I kind of had to look at my own analysis and be like, is that because of my pre-exposure to Johnny Depp as right. Alice in Wonderland Mad Hatter, or is it because Johnny Depp just embodies this chaos?
Right.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's our own expectations.
Yeah, and so when I was reading the first chapter, and again, I had the experience with this book as I was reviewing before our discussion today. I had which I often have in watching movies I haven't watched for a long time, where I'm like, okay, where should I stop, you know, to consider the opening, right? And so I was reading all the way through to the end of the first chapter, and what I kept expecting was all of these times, right, again, the context of this is Mrs. Darling looking into and tidying up the minds of her children, right, and therein or thereby discovering Peter Pan keeps coming up more often in their minds, and I expected that to be a kind of transitional tool, right? To transition to the children, to focus on Wendy and the children again. The first mm-hmm. paragraph seemed to promise that Wendy was our primary character, right? And then we shifted to Mrs. Darling, but we keep not leaving her. Mrs. Darling is still the protagonist through to the end of chapter one. And it's that really kind of caught me by surprise.
That's really interesting.
I really
making the mom the frame.
Yes. Yes.
Whether we like it or not. Hmm.
The mother is sort of the frame all the way through. So, I mean, we come back after all of these, you know, the descriptions of that there's more. Occasionally in her travels through the children's mind, Mrs. Darling found things she could not understand. And of these, quite the most perplexing was the word Peter. She knew of no Peter, and yet he was here and there in John and Michael's minds, while Wendy's began to be scrawled all over with him. We get a little conversation between her and Wendy. Mrs. Darling consulting Mr. Darling, expecting it to blow over. Anyway, Mrs. Darling, she finds leaves on the floor and by the window, and Wendy says, oh, Peter must have not, like, wiped his shoes before he came in through the window. And the whole thing is like, then like Mrs. Darling, like looking to see, well, there are leaves right outside the window. You know, there is a tree right outside the window and nobody could come in this window. Nobody could climb up to the window. And, but it's all about like Mrs. Darling sort of discovering, right. And the chapter ends with Mrs. Darling waking up and seeing Peter Pan, and gnashing his teeth at Mrs. Darling because he sees that she's a grown-up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, like up through and including the arrival of Peter Pan himself on the scene, Mrs. Darling is still our protagonist as far as the book is concerned. Anyway, so that's as far as like what we get at the opening of this is what we, you know, to as far as I could possibly extend what I would define as the opening of this book, which is the end of chapter one. It's, this is still a book about Mrs. Darling. And Edith, yes, I do believe that the reference to his first teeth. So she says that, describing Peter Pan, he was a lovely boy clad in skeleton leaves and the juices that ooze out of trees. I was sort of imagining, like, typing into an AI image generator what it would look like to have a boy clad in skeleton leaves and the juices that ooze out of trees. Like,
terrifying,
that's not a...
the answer. No.
Yeah, that's not a very fulsome visual description.
And don't forget to tell AI that he's gnashing his little pearls.
Gnashing his little pearls, yeah.
That doesn't sound good either.
Exactly. Exactly. No. But the most entrancing thing about him was that he had all his first teeth, which I do believe means his baby teeth. Yeah.
You start losing those at like 6 or 7, right?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's a different skew, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can probably see why it was interesting for us to take a look at this first, because our adaptations are real different.
And it's, it was one of the things that I was thinking of. So when I read this, I'm like, okay, I can believe that the movies come from the same trunk, but it's not. This is a different branch. Like this seems to me to be going in a totally different direction.
This is a different forest. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because even think about the, it's not merely the fact that Mrs. Darling has been the focal point of almost the entire narrative to this point. It's also like the seeds that have been planted, you know, like how Tolkien plants the seed for the Hobbit in chapter one by saying that, you know, during this story, you know, Mr. Baggins lost the respect of his neighbors, but he gained, well, we'll see if you think he gained anything in the end, right? So like that gives us a little prompting of like, what is the thing that's going to happen?
Story about an adventure, yeah.
Yeah, like where are we headed? And so sometimes when you get those kind of little promptings at the beginning of a story, it helps you to kind of know where you're going. Honestly, again, trying to rid my mind of everything else I ever knew about Peter Pan. This is chapter, I'm reading the book. I've never heard this story before. I'm reading chapter one. What I would say is this is a story about that secret inner box within Mrs. Darling and mm-hmm. that kiss that's on her mouth that nobody can mm-hmm. get.
That right? they've talked about an awful lot.
Yes, that has come up on multiple important. Occasions. Yes. Mm-hmm. So like, and how, and the interface between the, so like Wendy's acknowledgments of Peter Pan, her, like, so there's this clear difference between how Mrs. Darling looks at the Neverlands that I think she's kind of touring or at least examining when she's going through her children's minds, but she doesn't fully understand. The gap is clear when she says, who's Peter? And Wendy's like, oh, Peter Pan, of course. You know, Peter Pan. Like, it's, you know, it's like a given to Wendy, but Mrs. Darling doesn't know anything about it. And so there's a clear sort of difference there. But if anything, it feels like a rediscovery of the inner child story of Mrs. Darling. Like, I this chapter leads me to believe that like the culmination of the book is going to be Mrs. Darling finally like bestows the kiss, like opens the inner box and bestows the kiss, you know.
If you'd started with just the first two paragraphs, I could have seen how this feeds into the things that we know, because that sounded mm-hmm. really interesting. That was, you know, Wendy noticing at age two that she's gonna have to grow up one day. Yep.
Yes.
That's on point. I can see our foundations, but that's the end of it. And we only see John and Michael mentioned once as a financial transaction. So focusing in on that trio as our protagonist doesn't really fit what we're seeing here. Like you said, take out everything you know of Peter Pan, and really we just have this crazy frame story of this woman who seems kind of mad unpacking her children's brains every night, and then yes. is haunted by a weird boy that goes into her children's dreams and looks like a weird tiny monster when yes. she actually sees him. Like, it really does start to set up like a horror story and not a children's coming of age story.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, or at least it would sure be easy to build a horror story on this premise.
Completely. I mean, you can see why there's probably some really strange adaptations that are horror out there. I wonder what this would be in comparison to other texts of the time. You know, like, I wonder if there's other things coming out in the 1920s that are of the same style. So he felt like he fit in, or this was just the way people wrote.
Yeah.
This is weird.
It's very strange. There is, so if you think about it, the tone, like the narrator's tone is, it's, I'm not saying that subject matter or the things being described, but the tone of the narration doesn't strike me as wholly different from Winnie the Pooh, especially in the introduction. Mm-hmm. The Winnie the Pooh narrator is trying to capture, like, not only the tone of reading to a child, but the whole event of reading to a child, including the child interrupting with questions, right, during the narrative. So this narrator is trying to capture something else, and yet the way in which I agree with Phil that the tone does seem to imply a very young audience. I mean, notice it's clear that children are being addressed directly by the narrator. Mm-hmm. If you, I'm thinking of the children's minds paragraph. Right, when he uses the second person, that's what I was remembering. If you could keep awake, but of course you can't, you would see your own mother doing this. Right? So mm-hmm. he's explicitly addressing young children in the second person. So, and that kind of bleeds over into some of the way that things are described. Mrs. Darling was married in white, and at first she kept the books perfectly, almost gleefully, as if it were a game. Not so much as a Brussels sprout was missing. That he uses Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and associates that with accounting and bookkeeping, which I think seems fairly transparently designed to convey to us, especially if the us is a juvenile audience, exactly what Mrs. Darling's attitude towards home economics was, right? That she viewed keeping the books like you might view cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, right? Vegetables that your parents make you eat, but that you probably don't particularly enjoy. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's, yeah.
I'm trying to not just go straight to comparison, but I think I have to. So I just had to look up the 1904 script of the original stage play.
Yes.
Not the same as this. The stage play is very similar to what we're all familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So where did this come from? I might be taking back my they're both original source material because it's the same author. But they're not. They're not at all.
Yeah, this is... It's a... So, okay. What do we do with the differences between the original play and this? Both by the author.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it...
This is a great example for canon, isn't it?
It really is. You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of the conversation we had with John Howe and how we were talking about, in many ways, even the original work by any artist is merely an adaptation, an attempt by them to capture that thing that they see.
Nothing.
Right? That the real original is the story, the picture, the image as it exists in the mind or as the mind kind of glimpses. And which the author is attempting to capture, or the painter is attempting to capture, though neither painter nor author would probably ever say that they feel they've really done it, right? That most authors and most painters would probably say that their entire careers and all of their work are like some getting closer and some further away, but never really capturing on canvas or in words that thing that they're hearing or seeing or whatever. And with some authors like Tolkien, we can get some really interesting angles on this because we can see him try to capture the same thing in words and in paint, for instance, on some occasions. Or we can see him try to capture the same thing in poetry and in prose on some occasions, which is also another really interesting thing to look at. Here we have, if we assume for the moment that J.M. Barrie is trying to capture the same thing, right, in these two different modes, the very different thing, and maybe, you know, so Alan is asking, and it's very good, very good point, says the play would have been for an adult audience at that time. Well, I think didn't kids go to plays at least sometimes? I'm trying to remember.
And wasn't that this whole thing was for like the children's hospital in Ormstree? I mean, this was for children, right?
I don't know.
Maybe it was just a beneficiary.
Yeah, I mean, they were certainly a beneficiary. The book, again, the book is explicitly addressing children. That's not to say that it's not interested in the adults as well. I see JJ is quoting the line. This is what Alice says after she reads the Jabberwocky poem. Somehow it seems to fill my head with ideas, only I don't exactly know what they are. Alice's famous response to the Jabberwocky poem full of words she doesn't know. It fills her heads with ideas, but she doesn't know how to point to them. That's, of course, what words do. right, is they help you to identify ideas, right? They attach names to things. And when you detach the names from things, you end up in this state like Alice described. Her head is still full of ideas, but she can't say them. She doesn't know what they are. Anyway.
But that's a fun way to think about this. I mean, if it's, we're just speculating here, but if it's Jay and Barry trying to articulate some ethereal thought that he can't quite grasp, like the loss of childhood, you know, I mean, that is a big topic. That's a big theme. And he tried it in a stage play and it worked one way. So he wants to try it in a novelization and see if he can make it work in a different way.
Yeah.
It's the same idea to him.
Yes.
In two different platforms, in two different versions, still an adaptation, but it's not at the same time. That's really interesting.
Or at least it's certainly not what this certainly suggests to me. There is no sense in which you could just say this novel is like a novelization of the play, like that he's doing the same story in novel form. He's not. He may be getting at the same idea, as you say. That seems to me a much better way to describe this. And I think I agree. I mean, I'm not enough of an expert in Peter Pan, in any of the forms of Peter Pan, to say. But it seems to me certainly plausible on the surface to say that the core concept, right, the core thing that is being brought to the surface and wrestled with is childhood, the loss of childhood, the memory of childhood, the relationship between childhood and adulthood, like youth and growing up. Like, that's the issue here, right?
And that was, I mean, the two that we were going to talk about tonight, we're kind of going around this because this is so different, but the two we were going to talk about tonight is the Disney animated version and the 2003 Jason Isaacs version. And the 2003 version I specifically was looking at because of how they handled that transition. First of all, I love that adaptation. James Newton Howard did the music. It was all Industrial Light and Magic special effects. It just had this real feel of magic about it. But how they dealt with like the relationship and the romantic aspects between Peter and Wendy just hadn't really been approached by any adaptation beforehand. And it got a lot of kickback and flack for that. But it's an important element of that transition from childhood to grown up that I think was a really brave way to kind of engage with that theme. And just a neat thing to see on screen between those two characters.
Yeah, I will admit, from the first time I saw the Disney film as a kid. No, I was not aware of it the first time I saw it, but I wasn't that old in rewatching Peter Pan before the character, I'm talking the Disney cartoon now. The character of Tinkerbell began to creep me out. The like explicit sexual jealousy of Tinkerbell from the first moment she comes on screen. Right. And the way in which that sort of triangle between Peter and Wendy and Tinkerbell, where Tinkerbell is hyper conscious of sexual rivalry with Wendy over Peter from the first moment. Wendy is peripherally and like kind of not focused on it, like, but she's like not totally oblivious to it. And Peter, who's utterly oblivious to the entire thing, right? And like both the fact that we have this like sexual triangle going on in the midst of this growing up, you know, of this kid's story, whatever. And I've always found it really uncomfortable.
And now I'm finding it more uncomfortable because he still has all of his baby teeth. So is he six?
He's like six or seven? Yeah.
That's got more of a problem. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so on the one hand, like when thinking about the issue of childhood and growing up, right? I don't deny the relevance of sexual awakening to that theme, right? Like that's surely an element of passing from childhood to adulthood, and it's certainly one storytelling wise sort of compelling way to try to point at or kind of discuss what's at stake. And there are a couple different ways in which the idea of sexual awakening and the whole idea of childhood and adulthood, where it can kind of come in. So I acknowledge all that, but it still makes me really uncomfortable. Like,
it's still weird. Yeah.
It's yeah. I the way in which it feels like it. Okay, I think I know why it makes me so uncomfortable. It makes me so uncomfortable because one of the fundamental questions that Peter Pan seems to be asking is like, what's the line? Where's the line between adulthood and childhood? Like, at what point do you have to grow up? Whether it's in the book where we're told age two is the beginning of the end, or whether it's in the Disney film when Wendy's going to be moved out of the nursery, right? Somewhat arbitrarily by her father because he's decided like it's time for her to be to grow up now, right? And start thinking about grown-up things. How old do you think Wendy is in the film, in the Disney, in the cartoon?
In the Disney one? I mean, she still looks quite young. I guess I would have said like eight, nine.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Somewhere between 8 and 10, maybe.
Yeah, 8 and 10.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Anyway, so and of course, it's also a very interesting sort of cultural question, and it varies so widely from culture to culture. That is the question of when children are understood to be considered adults or to begin to undertake adult responsibilities. And goodness knows our society is one which is slower than any society I've ever heard of in the history of Earth to do that. That is like, you know, we consider, you know, kids until they're way past the age where like every other society in, you know, the history of Earth has considered them adults. But still, like, there's a lot of variance there, right? And the idea of projecting, of associating, like, growing up with some kind of sexual awakening, the more you're projecting that backwards, the more uncomfortable it feels, because it feels like you're sort of forcing a kind of sexual dynamics onto a like relationships or onto perceptions which don't intrinsically have them. I mean, I remember when Maggie, I don't know if you've already encountered things like this with Hazel, but when my kids were little, when my boys were little, I remember like we had there was a neighbor family down the street that had like I have two boys, they had two girls, and they would often play together. And like, there's this almost inescapable with some people. Like, I was never like to kind of sexualize it, right? To kind of talk about it as if like they're courting each other or something.
Yeah, I haven't encountered that, but that is like such a trend in parenting Instagrams and things like that now, of just, you know, trying to steer the conversation around your children early on, that when you see a boy and a girl together, age 2 and 3, you don't start going, oh, what a cute couple. Oh,
exactly. Yes. That exact kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was always just like, no, they're friends. Let them be friends.
They're tiny.
And they're tiny. Yes. It's like, why are we projecting this? Mm-mm. Back on and anyway,
it's so common that it's become like a societal norm to ask that question. And it's like, no, who said that this was okay to put upon people? Because
exactly. So I think that's why even in the Disney film, Tinkerbell seems to me to force the question. Like, it forces us to think. We get her cue to think about Wendy and Peter's relationship.
As a relationship.
In that way, right? Mm-hmm. 'Cause Tinkerbell's thinking it from the first moment, right? It makes me uncomfortable because, again, it feels like merely an adult projection.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting thing, it strikes me. What J.M. Barrie is doing in the novel, at least in chapter one here, is almost the other way around. Instead of like speaking to an adult audience and inviting them to project adult things backwards, he's speaking to a child audience, but asking them throughout to put themselves in the position of the parent of Mrs. Darling.
I guess that's what he's doing, but it's so confusing. I can't really imagine any child picking up on what they're supposed to be looking at, because I'd still be focusing on that 2-year-old little Wendy picking a flower and giving it to their mother. Like, that is the sentiment that makes sense to me. The rest of it just feels like a writing prompt exercise.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure to what end, but...
Well, okay, so I'm thinking about...
I'm picturing the adults in the ridiculous way the children might see them.
Yeah. In some ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In some ways. I think that some of the kind of silliness... I'm staring at the sentence. Mrs. Darling was married in white. It's like, well, of course she was, right? But like, picturing it from a child's perspective, you can definitely see why, like, she wore a white dress that day would be like, that's like a big deal.
Memorable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the memory. And it needs to be said here, as opposed to the rest of it. I'm thinking about the scene, the unpacking the mines mm-hmm. scene, right? That's where he explicitly addresses the children in the audience. If you could keep awake, you would see your own mother doing this, and you would find it very interesting to watch her, right? And then he describes what you would see if you could watch your mother repacking your mind, going through and repacking your mind after you're asleep. So he's inviting the children to imagine the parental experience. And he segues mm-hmm. from there, almost stream of consciousness wise, into the map of a person's mind, the map of a child's mind, which is, of course, the map of Neverland, obviously, though I don't have to tell you what Neverland is. So in this way, I think it's like we're getting a story which is insisting on remaining with the grown up Mrs. Darling. And yet we're kind of getting it from the child's perspective, even in her conversation with the way it sticks with her perspective in the conversation with Wendy. Right. It's like he's inviting the children to imagine the other half of their conversations with their parents. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And how their parents, why Mrs. Darling is confused, what she thinks about the leaves on the floor and the statement that Peter Pan came in. Right. Like, he gives us Wendy's statements, which are statements, you know, maybe that the kids themselves could relate to, right? Like, I'll say things like that to my mom, right?
That's a nice separation, because, the more I'm looking at it, it's like, oh, well, the stuff coming from the kids is the absolute clarity. Of course that makes sense, Mom. Well, he left the leaves by the door, didn't he? He comes through the window, obviously.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
a very, like, geez, Mom. And it's
yes.
her... side of the story that makes no sense, so it's their perception of life.
Yeah.
So that works.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the quite famous trope, which is quite famous in children's stories even, I think, by this time, of, you know, the children who have adventures that their parents can't see or understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, don't bother telling the adults, they won't get it, but, like, the children, they see these things, and these things happen to them, and like, but, you know, by the end, they're tucked in bed, and their parents don't realize they were ever gone. You know, like, that kind of children's story, which is, like, we are investing in the world, in the world of the childhood imagination, right, and inviting you to indulge in this and imagine the adventures that you're having. But it's separate. This is why, like, you know, Disney moms are all dead, right, and every, at least for, you know, for so much of Disney movies and stuff, like, outside of the world of parental control and everything, right?
Absolute token tick mark, and get rid of the parents so the kids can have an adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's almost like he's reversed that.
Yeah.
Right. Given that kids are having adventures, now, children, imagine this from the parents' perspective and how they are thinking about this, right? How they relate to this, prophecy, how they come to understand this, especially since, like, that, again, that inner, the box inside of boxes and the inner box that has never been opened by anyone, and the kiss that she's never given to anybody, including Mr. Darling no longer even tries to get it anymore. Wendy knows she's never received it. So, like, there's something, there's some kind of love, there's some kind of affection that Mrs. Darling has been holding in her whole life and that nobody has gotten. Maybe Napoleon would have, but probably not. And how strange, like, Napoleon?
How strange, Napoleon. But again, kid's brain, right? Like,
kid's brain, yeah. He's a great conqueror, so he might have conquered it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, some throwaway line about a big king, you know? It's just that kind of vibe. But even, like, the kiss in the box, they're completely not understood by the people talking about them either, because they're just kind of confusing. Like, we don't really know what this kiss in this box are, but we know it's a big deal, so...
Right.
It does sound like a kid telling a story.
Right. Well, because I think from the beginning, given the fact that, again, I think it's important that we only have the story focused on Mrs. Darling starting in paragraph 2. Right. The first paragraph is Wendy. So that's establishes her as like the frame of the frame. The frame is Mrs. Darling, but the frame of Mrs. Darling is Wendy. Right. Wendy's perceptions. So even the description of Mrs. Darling, her romantic mind was like the tiny boxes, one within the other, that came from the puzzling East. You get the feeling, I get the feeling anyway, that this is like how Wendy thinks of her mother's mind, right? Yeah. And so that idea of the one inner box that was never opened, and explicitly Wendy is connected with a kiss. Her sweet mocking mouth had one kiss on it that Wendy could never get. Right. So that is explicitly Wendy's interpretation, like how Wendy kind of, makes concrete for herself this thing that she's perceiving about her mother.
Thing. Right.
Yeah. So it's not like it's a grown-up book. It's still a kid's book from a kid's perspective. But it's, again, at least through chapter one, persistently about adults and
invite it's heady.
Yes.
You know? I mean, when you really do start thinking about this, you're like, whoa, this is some deep stuff, but they're presenting it in such a simplistic child interpretation way that you really have to work a little bit to read through that.
I mean, think about the themes that are implicit in this chapter, like happiness and marriage and, the abilities of couples to connect with each other, relate to each other, and get along through a life together with a family. Kids are being asked to think about that here, about the relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Darling. That's tough. Like, this is a real challenge.
And the transaction nature of having children and, the value placed upon a relationship, parental or couple, and it's very different.
Yeah, it's almost like, again, going back to Jan Barry trying to capture something, it's almost like at the start of this book, at least, he's like, okay, let me try to come at that from the opposite direction. let's try to get there, but let's try to get there completely differently.
I mean, if this is the theme we're looking at, like this really heady, intense look at growth and relationships, I don't think I necessarily see that immediately in the adaptations. So the theme that they're taking forward is the more simplistic, I don't want to grow up. And we kind of lose, we kind of lose this deep nugget. I don't know.
I wonder.
Other ways to project that, but.
You're right. Perhaps the when you grow up or whether or not you grow up or what the transition between childhood and adulthood is like. It does seem the chapter one of the book, at least, suggests that that's not actually the main idea. I think you're right. I think it's more about like. Again, it's about that secret box and that kiss, right? It's about being happy, unlocking your inner self, right? The, you know, finding and like negotiating happiness and satisfaction in your life and in relationships and your connection to people and growing up is a part of that. Refusal to grow up is one, you know, forgetting childhood entirely is one way to cope with this, right? Refusing to grow up is a different way to cope with this, but it's neither one of them is really the core issue. Yeah, it strikes me that actually Hook deals with that theme more directly than the more direct adaptation Disney cartoon does.
Completely. And I mean, I guess that's obvious because we're looking at a grown-up Peter. So we're being forced to take a look at this, you know, the reverse of the thing that we knew. And he's forgotten how to be Peter. So he's a crotchety, angry businessman that forgets how to be a beloved, you know, heartfelt, light kid. So I guess that makes sense. But that absolutely makes sense that he's the one that pulls it off. And it's that kind of separation that makes it fall so much bigger. It's because he has so much farther to travel to become like a young boy again. That fits. And it was rewatching that opening of Hook that Corey and I were talking before we started of just, it's been so long since I've seen Hook that I don't know if I've ever seen this opening. I feel like it was one of those movies that was always on TV growing up and I just tuned in like 20 minutes in. I just don't know if I ever saw that opening scene. And it opens with a play. So, you know, it's a play frame that we see in like so many adaptations. So we start with the play on stage and him being a crotchety, uptight businessman taking a phone call in the middle of his daughter's play and prompts.
And his daughter's playing Wendy. Yeah.
His daughter's playing Wendy. Yeah. And his son is sitting next to him saying, "You can't have a meeting tomorrow morning, Dad. It's my baseball game. Oh, I'll be there. You know, don't worry." Just blown him off kind of a thing. But yeah, so we're getting the total opposite of what we think Peter to be. And that's a smart, you know, storytelling move. So by the end of the film, when he comes full circle to being that beloved, loving boy again, even as a grown man, we see that journey. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But that's much more reflective, I think, of the process we're being asked to go through in this, yes, which I had not thought about before.
Yeah. Mm. And it's interesting, of course, Hook it corresponds really interestingly to the Johnny Depp Alice in Wonderland adaptation and the Christopher Robin, you know, so we've had three sort of sequels after people grew up adaptations that we've been talking about. We've hit on one. We didn't plan this, but we've hit on one of those for each one of the children's books that we did. Yeah, it's been kind of cool. It's been kind of cool. Hook is very different.
Sorry, I was also just thinking of that moment in Hook where we get the reveal of Captain Hook and the wig comes flying off and we see him as an old man. Yeah, so he grows up, he ages, and we see that kind of other side of growing up. It's not child to adult, it's adult to old man. And that's just as scary and sad and unnerving. Yeah, there wasn't really an end to that. Just like, and that hit hard too. So like, who knew Hook was carrying the heavy lifting of getting these themes from the text onto screen?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that the main difference it felt to me, both the Alice adaptation and the Christopher Robin adaptation has the like human frame character be the one who has grown up, right? Mm. That Christopher Robin should someday grow up, get a job, and focus on his job. Like, yeah. That's gonna happen, right? It's not necessarily something you want to think about when you're reading Winnie the Pooh necessarily, but it's like he is a boy and that's gonna happen, right?
Right.
Alice is a little girl. And that's going to happen. Indeed, the narrator even invites us to think about years later with Alice at times and her remembering back to things. But here, we have the fairy character himself having somehow grown up, mm-hmm. which is very, it's so unexpected that I feel there's a kind of resistance to it. Right. Like if you presumably, I went back and rewatched one of the trailers for Hook, like the official trailer for the movie, which I didn't remember the official trailer back, which was, I was still in high school when it came out, but, but if you watch the trailer, it'll spoil it for you. So I'm not trying to keep this as a secret, but from the beginning of the film, there is no hint who the Peter character is. There is a clear indication that his family is somehow related to the story, right?
Yeah.
That his grandmother, his granny Wendy, oh, Wendy, is the real Wendy in some sense, right? I mean, you know, his daughter Maggie, which is confusing because it's Maggie Smith that she's running up to, right? But anyway, goes up and says, I played you, in the school play. So there's this sense that there's like a personal connection, family connection, but that he's actually Peter Pan, who left Neverland and grew up. I was trying to decide, like, when does the opening end? And I'd watched like the first 20 minutes before I was like, okay, I think we can safely say we're past the opening now, right? but at no point in there is there any clear indication of who he is. Whereas again, that we know that Alice is Alice from the opening minutes, right? And anyway, she was always a human girl who was going to grow up. We know that Christopher Robin is Christopher Robin because we take him straight from the Hundred Acre Wood to boarding school and watch his whole growing up process. but
yeah, we don't get the Peter reveal for a very long time.
No, the legitimate mystery of who he is and what it means, which I think is sort of meant to map onto the, like, what seems to be his, like, quasi amnesia, right, of
mm-hmm.
Neverland, right, that we mm-hmm. sort of share. It doesn't, it's not revealed to us until it comes back to him, basically. Mm-hmm. Though it seems that Wendy clearly remembers it, like when in that scene on the stairs, when, you know, when okay, Maggie Smith first makes her entry at the top of the stairs there, it's clear that she remembers, right? Mm-hmm. The line, so Peter, you've become a pirate, right? It's clear that she remembers, but the audience has been given no clear indication of that. So it feels to me it's a very similar kind of adaptation concept, but it's the frame is so very different that I think mm-hmm. it ends up being a very significantly different experience.
I would agree. And taking that relationship too, I feel like it's in that moment you do see a little bit of the relationship, like the romantic relationship between them, because you get that passage of time. You kept coming through the window saying, I waited for you. And then I became an old woman. You know, so we see her kind of progress through that generation and have that realization of, oh God, you know, the heart was there. Like her relationship to him was different than I think what we were initially, and I hadn't really thought about it that way, but we do kind of have that reference to that relationship without it being as overt and awkward. Who knew Hook was doing the heavy lifting?
But yeah, I mean, I do think that there is some pretty heavy lifting that's going on there. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot, it's hard because, of course, having watched the three of them together, you know, all three of those adaptations are very interested in the I'm growing up and transitioning to, you know, you've got the proposal, right, with Alice. It's like literally the moment where she's going to stop being a child and enter into the adult social world, and her decision as to whether or not to do that, or of course in the end she does it in a different way, but still it's still that moment of transition. With Christopher Robin is well past the moment of transition, but we see the moments of transition happen, right? And then it's a question of sort of looking back across that, and sort of trying to rediscover that. But anyway, it's the whole loss of childhood theme, like the whole like Peter. I feel like there's this really kind of striking dimension that the film adds to it. The whole like, oh, dad is too busy to pay attention to his kids and he misses the son's. He's talking on the phone during the daughter's play and he misses the son's baseball game and stuff. Feels kind of old hat. You know, it's like, well, it's very standard.
It feels very standard. And it is Steven Spielberg. So you're just like, yeah, tick. It's,
right.
It's providing that characterization of the disconnected dad.
Right. But where it goes after that, like.
Yeah.
When his children are actually lost, right? And the way that that kind of superimposes this new level of like, you have lost your childhood, like you have missed your children. The way that that gets literalized in this new way, but then this new, there's, you know, but through that, you know, we get the discovery of this new, the new dimension, right? Of how this is not just a boy like Christopher Robin who grew up and left childhood things behind and, you know, began to live a bleak and empty adult life, right, in which he was losing track of love and what matters most and things like that. This is Peter Pan. This is the fairy himself, right?
Yeah, like what Phil just said, like, it's sad, but the fact that it's Peter Pan makes it horrific that he, too, can succumb to becoming a grown-up. Exactly. Like,
so, like, in retrospect, that opening becomes horrifying. Yes.
Horrifying. But this was the kid that was so scared to grow up, and he grew up and forgot everything. Like, that's so sad.
Yeah, like the dimension that is added to like his fear of flying.
Yeah.
Right on the airplane. Yeah.
Oh, there's so many parts of that that are making a lot more sense on like deeper levels now. Just.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The fear and the sadness of it and the loss of that. I'd be interested to see the deleted scenes or that film of that transition of him moving into the Darling household and becoming the businessman Peter.
Yes. Yeah. I just think how different the film would be if it started that way. Like if that were the frame. Right.
Mm. Yeah. If it opened with him being adopted and we knew from the beginning that that's what it was. Interesting, informative, not nearly the same payoff, not nearly the same kind of trauma that we have to process.
Yeah.
Because then you get like individual trauma being seen on screen as well as the father relationship, you know, like healing that relationship with Maggie and particularly his son. Maggie's the daughter's name, isn't it?
Maggie's the daughter, yeah.
Yeah, and particularly his son. Like you have all of this growth happening at the same time that he's realizing his own inner child. Maybe that's his inside box, you know, what's inside there.
Yeah. 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 Now, Edith, I agree.
I know.
It's just, so Edith says, how sad is it, though, that growing up always means losing magic? Why can't it be like C.S. Lewis says, that someday you'll be old enough to read fairy tales again? Yes, and actually, Edith... Yeah, exactly. And if I could allude back to an earlier part of our conversation, this is another thing that always makes me uncomfortable about the sexual triangle aspect of it, is like the sense that like magic is traded for sex. Right, like that those are the two, that's the trade-off, right? Like sex is what you get in the adult world and magic is what you have in the child world, and I'm like, that's not a cool exchange. Like
not the same currency.
Not the same currency for one thing. Like, what is it impossible to have both or one or like what? It's just like, but that those two things are like kind of connected in this way, and I feel like that's often a thing. Right. I mean,
yeah, I wonder if that's just like a trope that developed that people latch on to unconsciously. Like it's a thing that just keeps happening. So it's a formula that works. We'll just keep perpetuating it because that sucks.
Yeah. Is it meant to be like, you know, romance and sex is meant to be like, what, a consolation? Like this is the wonderful thing you get in the adult life that children are ignorant of. Right. So when they I don't I don't know.
We have to end on a happier note than that. This is turning to a dark place.
Peter
Pan, who knew?
But yeah, I mean, it's yeah, we've talked very little about the Disney film. We talked relatively little about the Disney film, except talk about being uncomfortable with it. Well, there's lots to be uncomfortable about. In the Disney film,
it's one of the classics that now has a disclaimer in front of it saying, "Hey, a lot of these depictions are not cool."
Not cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am glad they didn't just censor it. You know, that I think is a, that I think is a strong approach, but, yeah, I'm trying to think where the, well, no, focusing on openings. Let's focus. Let's keep the focus on openings. Let's not think. I'm not going to think about the end of the Peter Pan cartoon. I'm going to think about the beginning.
That's and a whole separate series where we talk about endings.
We talk about endings. Yeah. And we may get there someday, but,
Someday.
It's harder. Closings are so much harder than openings though, because the last scene isn't necessarily like, it may be what
because
you're actually left with.
Correlation because so much before it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the opening, this is going to inform and frame your experience no matter what. Yeah. So the opening, the first few minutes, the first few pages always do that whether you want them to or not.
Especially when we're talking about analysis, like it just makes sense for openings. Like there is a comparative, you know, side by side. I think we probably will get to the point where we do scenes. So here's the scene from the text and here's the scene in two adaptations. But yeah, closings are tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so in the opening, I feel that the opening of the Disney film really pushes against, like, so the character of Mr. Darling, right, is made an absurd grown-up, an absurd, intolerant, bumbling, clueless grown-up figure, right? And he's a little bit that in the book even, but he, you know, with his calculations and his accountancy and his respect versus love thing and stuff. There's, but still, in that, but we don't get, he's made almost the antagonist in the film, in the Disney film, the cartoon. Almost the antagonist in the sense that he is actively against the stories. He is determined to squash those things. So when he says to Wendy that this is her last night in the nursery, it's
cruel.
Yeah, there's it's almost vindictive. Like he's frustrated and embarrassed by the fact that they've hidden his gold cufflinks because they're the buried treasure, and they've written on his shirt front and all, you know, and he's tripped over the blocks and everything else, right? That he, and Wendy's stories are what is at the root of all of this, and so he's going to put an end to that nonsense, for the sake of his own like convenience and peace of mind, not thinking about the well-being of children at all.
It feels like Mr. Banks and Mary Poppins. Like, I'm just gonna run this show, sit down, and here's my demands, and I'm gonna run the house this way, only to be shown you're a fool.
Yes. Yeah, and as Gregory points out, I says it's interesting that in most adaptations in plays, Mr. Darling and Hook are played by the same actor, but it certainly feels, I mean, Hook seems to be a stand-in for that, the adult world, the adult masculine world in particular, and therefore Mr. Darling is the only touch point we have on that all the way through, seems clear, and especially clear, I think, in the Disney film, right? He is the adult male, irrational enemy of Peter Pan, who just like hates everything about Peter Pan, and wants to stop Peter Pan doing Peter Pan things. And that's exactly the position we see Mr. Darling in the opening scene there.
And I think you see it really clearly in the 2003 one too with Jason Isaacs, that he is the hard, steadfast, firm line father, you know, no messing around, none of this nonsense.
Yes.
But his hook is incredibly, his Captain Hook character is incredibly jealous of Peter Pan and just wants to shoot him down literally and figuratively of,
right.
Oh, my nemesis, you're having too much joy. I can't have that. So that correlation really suits seeing the same actor in that role. I thought that was really effective.
Yes.
But that was apparently like a really early practice and stage that they just kind of continued as a tradition. But it works for these two characters, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me how the extent to which, at least in chapter one, he does not go there in the novel.
No.
With Mr. Darling.
We don't see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we get like, it's a little bit like the accountancy thing. Right.
But that's such an aside. Like that could have been anybody that had that comment. It didn't feel like it was much of a characterization of him.
No. Yeah, exactly. And of course, what seems really important to me is that those things open up as much of a gap between him and Mrs. Darling as they do between him and the children. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Darling in the Disney cartoon, she's a kind of intermediary figure. She's like the children. Like I think, for instance, when Nana the dog and Mr. Darling both, you know, do the Disney running around, breaking things in the room and then crash and fall. And comically, the children and Mrs. Darling are all being like, oh, Nana, are you OK? And nobody cares whether Mr. Darling's OK.
Right.
Right? Yeah. We see her alongside the children there. Right. Her sharing the perspective of the children. So she's a kind of ally of theirs against Mr. Darling, it seems, in some ways. She's resistant to him, it seems. But again, nothing like the way in which we see Mrs. Darling, you know, in chapter one of the book. Anyway,
Mrs. Darling of the book, we don't see.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't think I've seen that Mrs. Darling in any adaptation.
No.
I'm kind of interested.
It's very interesting. It's very interesting. All right. Well, as always, there's so much more to discuss, but we're out of time, and I know
once again
late
we
over
scratch
there.
The surface.
Yeah, exactly. There's always this is what happens when you try to have a discussion of like 4-5 different works, you know, in one conversation. But
maybe we'll focus, but not just yet. Right now, it's just kind of interesting to look at the big picture and be like, "Is it crazy that it started here and would end it here? And how do you think that got there?" So we'll zero in on some case studies as we go. I should be around next week, so we'll probably be normal time next week. But I'm traveling, so slim chance we might have to shaft.
Yeah,
but the
so we'll see. We'll see how travel goes. Yeah. So the week after next, we're gonna come in a special time, and we're gonna go back to Dune because we. So you may remember we did a special session with Dom and Trevor, who published a book on Dune, and we were talking about the old Dune adaptations with them. We wanted to connect with them again after Dune 2, to bring in some folks who are more Dune experts than we and get some of their perspectives on this. So we'll go back to Dune in a couple weeks for another little visit to Arrakis because it's worth discussing a little bit more.
There's still so much to unpack there. Like I think you and I need 3 or 4 more shows just on that adaptation. I just want a whole one on costume and a whole one on sound and epic.
But the special time is going to be 9 p.m. Yeah, 9 p.m. So that's April 1st. On April 1st, we'll be at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
It's not a joke.
Not a joke.
April Fool's.
It's actually
real. And
it's
not that late for me. I'll be on the East Coast, so don't worry. I'm not going to be up at 4 a.m.
Exactly. So apologies to people who are in Europe, our normal viewers who are in Europe. Sorry about that. But this is what happens when you get 2 special guests who are both based in America, that it's much easier for them to go in the evening. So anyway, so that's the plan for 2 weeks from now. Next week, we're hoping to be meeting at the normal time, but we'll see how Maggie's travel goes. So stay tuned to Signum social media for updates on that. All right.
Should be. I don't think we know what we're talking about yet, so we'll let you know. But
we're still kind of deciding what we're talking about. We're a little uncertain. We didn't decide because we weren't sure if we might want to talk about Peter Pan stuff more or what. So
we'll see.
All right. Week. Awesome. Thanks, everybody. And we will hopefully see you guys next week. If not, definitely the week after that. Thanks, everybody. Bye now.
Take care.